This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
The picture of a person given to us by economic theories of late capitalism, where we find ourselves, is of a rational agent seeking to maximize desires through the purchase of commodities which will satisfy those desires. And the person himself is able to acquire commodities because his labor is also a commodity, quantifiable, so that it can be exchanged supposedly for equal values of other commodities. The nature of individuals' desire is really of no interest to the economist, except to the extent that desires can be multiplied, made more complex, more desirable, to propel us, motivate us to expend more energy, more of our labor in their acquisition. But otherwise, they're not to be interrogated. And the presumption also is that desires are subjective states of individuals, and that they are for personal goods for which we're all in competition. And there's very little sense of goods in common or things that are created or acquired only in community. And since the 18th century and Adam Smith, there's been a kind of dogma that the interaction of all these individual desires adds up to something called the free market, which is the perfect sum and balance of all those individual desires. And that it is by each person pursuing their individual desire that the whole almost miraculously attains the best possible equilibrium and creates the fairest price for exchange of commodities. And I say almost miraculously because there's a very close connection between the theories of market equilibrium and the theories of deism that were around at the time of Adam Smith, in which Protestantism had evolved to a point of seeing the Creator not so much as actively intervening in the affairs of history, as rather as a first cause that set it all in motion, and set equally in motion a set of natural laws that kept the whole thing in place. And the world was considered to have that same kind of natural equilibrium set in motion by a benign creator that Smith then said the free market did as well. Now this becomes something of a dogma, like a religious dogma, to the extent that there's almost a kind of unshakable faith in the notion that this market equilibrium is the best of all possible worlds. And we hold on to that faith in spite of an endless amount of evidence to show that markets are subject to disruption and disequilibrium, crashes, and all sorts of inequalities, which somehow we, or the economic profession, tends to treat as fudgeable factors in an otherwise well-working system. And it's been pointed out that the whole notion of a harmoniously self-regulating system is a very convenient belief to have if you are one of the beneficiaries of the system as it is. So it's a theory that makes a lot of sense to capitalists and much less sense to workers. Now this whole picture, and I'm going through all this because it creates a certain kind of worldview of that's built up of individuals with desires that are considered to be givens and that are considered to interact spontaneously to create a certain kind of dynamic system that doesn't need any outside regulation and indeed can only be perturbed for the worse by attempts to improve it or regulate it. And when we're in the grip of a worldview like that, it often takes a radically different worldview to even begin to let us see that we're stuck in a view in the first place. And one of the things that happens in a practice like Buddhism is it offers a radical critique of the assumptions of the political and economic and psychological worldview of what we consider ordinary life. And it lays bare assumptions about the nature of individuality and desire and our relation to one another. See, in a kind of radical kind of way, Buddhism would say that neither the individual or their desires or their relations to other people are anything at all like the model you get in that of economic men. The dilemma for us is that Buddhism's critique is so radical. It's so radical as to sometimes appear otherworldly or in some sense incommensurable with the view of our ordinary lives. And in fact, I think it was meant to be incommensurable and that what it described was a picture of a way of seeing things and a way of living that required dropping out of life as it is. It's a in its original forms, Buddhism was designed by a set of monastic rules that basically said, individual desire or attachment or need is the problem, not something to be satisfied, but something in some sense or another to be eliminated. And that we could not in any way trust the ordinary workings of society to self-organize, but that we needed strict rules and a radical reorganization of human life into a monastic community in order to fulfill any of the ideals presented in Buddhism, that the world and the society that we find ourselves in is governed by so many wrong assumptions about what is good and right that we can't discover those things living in the world. Now, I remember many years ago, somebody told me that they had gone to see a famous Japanese Roshi and gone into the interview and asked, Roshi, tell me, how should I practice? And the Roshi said, die on the cushion! And the student had enough composure to ask back, are there any intermediate steps? Not told if he got an answer to that one. But I think that that is, in fact, our problem in our practice, to discover if there are any intermediate steps. We are not monks, and by and large we don't aspire to be monks, and we're trying to see, is there a way to interrogate the assumptions of our daily life without radically leaving it? Can we interrogate our assumptions about the nature of desire and who we are and what we want, and how that fits in together with our picture of other people and our relations to them? The way the Roshi did in that story, Buddhism tends to zero in on a question like, who wants it? That's a good question, but it's a hard question, and you can spend a very long time trying to answer it. I think a good intermediate question is, what do you want, and why do you want it? And where did you get the idea that that would make you happy? Or is it, do you want it because of some goal other than happiness? Intermediate questions ask us things like, what kind of person do you want to be? What do you think it's going to take to become that kind of person? And some things that we might discover that we want to be are not qualities we can cultivate in isolation. We tend to think of Buddhist practice as something we do in silence on a cushion, and we're sort of grateful for the fact that there's a little group that gives us, creates some peer pressure to sit still this long. But there's certainly a tendency to think that meditation is what's happening behind our eyelids, you know, as we sit quietly. But if you start thinking that what I want to be, kind of person I want to be, is more generous, that's not going to really happen by sitting and following your breath. It's going to have to evolve in interaction with real people, other people. And you're going to have to watch the ways in which in real life and in real time you're not generous. And why not? And what you hold on to and what you let go of and how you treat other people and what they want from you. Yeah, I think that the way I've attempted to bring a kind of psychological understanding to this practice is this sort of interrogation of our desires and our aspirations. Our desires being sort of the more immediate picture of what's going to make us happy and what do we think happiness is. And the other aspiration being, what kind of person do I want to be? I think it turns out that when we look at our desires, so many of them turn out to be, I want something that will protect me from my own vulnerability or the vulnerability of this world. I want something that will relieve me of my anxiety, my capacity to be hurt or insulted or abandoned, something that will free me from my dependency on other people for attention, for love, maybe just really for my physical well-being. All these things that we desire lead back to our insecurity and our fear and what we think is going to relieve it. And our aspirations, if we're not careful, tend in the direction of becoming a person who is invulnerable. And yet as these desires and aspirations get interrogated by practice, we may see that what we have in common is a shared vulnerability, a shared fear, that we are in this together and that it is not a zero-sum game where my security has to be purchased at the expense of yours. That it's possible to create something like a sangha or a community or friendship or love where the benefit of one is the benefit of the other. And that the line between giving and receiving becomes so blurred that it finally disappears.